Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Jason Cowley, editor of the New Statesman magazine. Welcome to the fine setting of One Birdcage Walk and to this New Statesman lecture. The New Statesman celebrated its centenary last year, and I'm delighted to say that the old publication is once again in robust health, both as a magazine and in various digital versions. I'm delighted also that the First Minister of Scotland, Mr. Alex Salmond, is here with us this evening at our invitation to make the case for Scottish independence right here in Westminster. Now, when I went to see the First Minister at his official residence, Bute House in Edinburgh, last summer, he said to me that we're in the early stages of what he called a phony war. We're just clearing the ground, you said. Well, the ground has been cleared, and the battle, if indeed we can call it a battle, has begun in earnest. A few words about the format tonight. The First Minister will speak for about 30 minutes, after which you'll have the opportunity to ask questions. I'm sure all of you will have many questions. Timetable's pretty tight. He has some broadcast interviews to give. So we're aimed to run, it's 7:20 now, so we're aimed to run to about 7:40. I hope you all have your copy of the Scotland Special, in which the First Minister published an essay and indeed interviewed Judy Murray of Murray Tennis fame. I hope you have Scotland's Future. I've been asked to mention this, a document that would tell you all about independent Scotland. Anyway, you're not here to hear me speak, so without further ado, may I ask the First Minister to step forward and to tell us why Scotland's future should be in Scotland's hands. Thank you.
Well, Jason, I want to clarify that rather thin document that Jason was holding up. That's only the abridged version. The full version is much, much of Scotland's future, much, much bigger than that. I'm sure there are copies around. But this is the second time in the last 8 days I've been next door to the United Kingdom Cabinet. Last week they paid a flying visit to Aberdeen while the Scottish Cabinet was in Portlethen, just 5 miles away. And this week I'm here at the heart of Westminster. And I mention this because if David Cameron does walk in any time during this session, then I've got the exclusive permission from Jason to change this into a debate format. What I also say that I was interested, there was a story in Independent today under the headline, "Is this the scariest photograph ever?" And it's a picture of David Cameron and myself at King's Cross Station, which was certainly scary to me, incidentally, but nonetheless, there we were at King's Cross Station advertising a Network Rail Rover card. But these were actually lookalikes, as opposed to... And my complaint about this, and I think what the Independent were alluding to in terms of the scariness of the picture, is that his lookalike more lookalike than my lookalike. My lookalike hasn't caught up with my 5+2 diet. And I demand accurate doppelgangers. I think it's only reasonable I get the respect of having a doppelganger who goes on the same diet as me. But it's worth a look. But, just for the record, we weren't at... in a railway carriage yesterday, and we didn't have the debate that the country should see, but the serious point is that debate will have to take place, and it will have to take place sooner rather than later. Now, it is a pleasure to be back in Westminster to deliver this New Statesman lecture. I've been asked by Jason to emphasise this point, just as I asked him to emphasise the white paper. I hope you have all bought a copy of your Scotland Special Edition, and I hope that it's given you some sense of the vitality of the debate that's currently taking place in Scotland. Now, I want to start tonight's speech by emphasising a point which occasionally the media and certainly UK politicians sometimes lose sight of. If we vote yes in September, then Scotland will become independent in more promising circumstances than virtually any nation in history. In fact, nobody really doubts that an independent Scotland could be successful. I shall quote the other doppelganger. Even David Cameron once put it like this. Supporters of independence will always be able to cite examples of small, independent, thriving economies such as Finland, Switzerland, and Norway. It would be wrong to suggest that Scotland could not be another such successful, independent country. He should have a word with his Chancellor occasionally, shouldn't he? But David Cameron omitted to mention that Finland's GDP per head is 10% higher than the UK's, Switzerland is 50% higher, and Norway is 85% higher per head, but nonetheless the point is well made. Now that consensus, the consensus about whether Scotland could be a successful independent country, it reflects the underlying economic strength of Scotland. We would become an independent country as one of the wealthiest nations in the OECD. Scotland has contributed more in taxes per person than the rest of the UK for every single one of the last 30 years. Last Thursday, Standard & Poor's, the rating agency, which for the duration of this speech I'm rechristening Standard & Rich, joined the consensus. It noted, quote, "In brief, we would expect Scotland to benefit from all of the attributes of an investment-grade sovereign credit characterised by its wealthy economy, roughly the size of New Zealand, high-quality human capital, flexible product and labour markets, and transparent institutions." That's of Standard & Poor's. However, the current balance sheet is only part of the economic story. We should also look at the potential of a country. Scotland has more universities in the world top 200 per head of population than any country in the planet. We have huge expertise in engineering and life sciences, an astounding cultural heritage, immense energy and natural resources, and above all, a skilled and inventive people. So there is no doubt, none whatsoever, that Scotland could be an independent country. The question the people of Scotland will answer on the 18th September is about whether we should be an independent country. And I want to put that forward tonight as essentially a choice between two futures. That's the real choice that I want to talk about this evening. In one way, Scotland with one choice will be part of what is an increasingly imbalanced United Kingdom with high social inequalities, growing regional disparities, and more often than not, governments we didn't vote for. With the other choice, we'll have the powers that we need to create a better country, to build the Scotland we want to see, the Scotland we seek. Now, I want to start with a letter sent recently by 27 Church of England bishops blaming the rise in food banks on, quote, cutbacks to and the failures in the benefit system. Now, the letter struck me for two reasons. The first is that when I was helping the Edinburgh South Food Bank just before Christmas, the Trussell Trust told me that in 2011, they have one food bank in the whole of Scotland, and now they run 43. 50,000 people in Scotland have used them in the last 9 months. And the second reason that the letter struck me was the strength, the unusual strength of the language used by the good bishops. It's been reflected, actually, in some of the comments recently made by the Archbishop of Westminster, now the Cardinal, Vincent Nicholls. And it struck me because it reminded me that it's 25 years ago, almost exactly to the day, that leaders of Scotland's three largest churches joined together to condemn a UK government policy as, quote, undemocratic, unjust, socially divisive, and destructive of community and family life. That letter, the letter from the Scottish churches, was written on the eve of the introduction of the poll tax in Scotland, and it expressed perfectly the widespread anger about the tax, which commanded support from only 10 of then 72 Scottish members of Parliament. And as this audience will know, the poll tax became a totemic issue in Scotland, the supreme example of a policy imposed upon us in the teeth of massive public opposition, and one reason why the Scottish people endorsed devolution so overwhelmingly in 1997 was to stop anything similar ever happening again. So it's worth repeating that phrase used by the church leaders 25 years ago: undemocratic, unjust, socially divisive, destructive of community and family life. Last April, the bedroom tax came into force. It is affecting more than 70,000 households across Scotland, 80% of whom have a disabled person. It was opposed by more than 90% of Scotland's MPs. And as we know, it's part of a package of welfare changes, again opposed by more than 90% of Scotland's MPs, which have seen the growth of food banks and which children's charities now forecast will see tens of thousands more children born into poverty by 2020. However, these policies, it should be understood, are exacerbating social trends which have actually prevailed over some considerable period of time. The OECD, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, reported 3 years ago that since 1975, inequality among working age people has increased faster in the United Kingdom than in any other member country. Even before the current government came into office, Professor Danny Dorling calculated the UK was the fourth most unequal country in the developed world, and it hardly seems likely that the position has improved since then. And regional inequalities have grown alongside social inequalities. The UK now has the highest levels of regional inequality of any country in the European Union. The UK's business secretary recently called London, quote, a kind of giant suction machine draining the life out of the rest of the country, unquote. Now, I'm a lot more moderate in my views than Vince Cable. I'll just repeat that. I'm claiming to be more moderate than a Liberal Democrat, okay? London, in my estimation, is one of the world's great cities, and much of that success should be celebrated. And it should be said also the gravitational pull of London isn't new. This building itself was constructed at the end of the 19th century because the Institution of Mechanical Engineers, which had been based in Birmingham since 1847, decided it should move to a London headquarters. But London's influence is infinitely stronger now. And it's impossible to deny that the attraction of capital and talent to London is one of the defining features of the UK economy. A recent report by the Centre of Cities noted that 80% of private sector job creation was taking place in London. And Professor Tony Travers of the LSE said, London is the dark star of the economy, inexorably sucking in resources, people and energy. Nobody knows quite how to control it. And again, David Cameron argued before he became Prime Minister that an economy with such a narrow foundation for growth is fundamentally wasteful and unstable. But the record is a lot weaker than the Prime Minister's words. A couple of years ago, the Institute for Public Policy in the Regions published a report called On the Wrong Track. It found that public spending on major transport infrastructure amounted to £2,600 per head in London, and £5 per head in the northeast of England. That's £5 per head in the northeast of England. Now, I'm the First Minister of Scotland, meaning all of Scotland. And if the government which I lead were responsible for such massive disparities, we wouldn't stand a chance of re-election. There's a growing realization that wealth and opportunities are too concentrated geographically as well as socially. And UK government policies are working for too few, denying opportunities for too many. Britain is imbalanced. But when I sat across the road first in the Westminster Chamber, the redoubtable Eric Heffer, the MP for Liverpool Walton, used to sit right behind me on the Labour backbenches. And Eric hadn't always favoured devolution, but the experience of Margaret Thatcher's government changed his mind. And whenever I was making speeches about Scottish independence, I used to hear Eric growling behind me, "Remember, Alec, Liverpool's coming way." Now, I'm not suggesting tonight that we take up Eric Heffer's offer. But it is interesting. In the last year, we've seen a real determination from councils and cities in the north of England to see a prosperous and empowered Scotland as an opportunity as opposed to a threat. The Association of North East Councils in Cumbria commissioned academic research which found, and I quote, the prospect of further autonomy for Scotland is also stimulating new interest in the North East Cumbria and Scotland to work more collaboratively together. We're now seeing a practical expression of that as the local authorities in both countries working together begin to explore how best to jointly promote business, tourism and above all transport links. The Borderlands Initiative, as it is known, highlights its practical cross-border cooperation, which would continue and indeed could be strengthened by Scottish independence, when the nations of these islands share a partnership of equals based on our many areas of common interest. And after Scottish independence, the growth of a strong Economic power in the north of these islands would benefit everyone, our closest neighbours in the north of England more than anyone. There would be a northern light to address the influence of the dark star, rebalancing the economic centre of gravity across these islands. Now, there are those who worry that Scottish independence would leave an England entrenched in conservatism, as Helena Kennedy put it in the New Statesman edition. However, it's worth noting that since 1945, there actually have only been two elections, in 1964 and the first election of 1974, where the largest party at Westminster would have been different if Scotland had been independent. These two governments sat for a total of 26 months. Independence would have very little impact on the political arithmetic at Westminster. Although it would finally provide the definitive answer to the West Lothian question, Scottish MPs would no longer vote on policies primarily or entirely concerning England. Indeed, Scotland, I would argue, will be a more influential and valuable as an independent nation than we can be by contributing 9% of Westminster MPs. We wouldn't, of course, always get things right. Sometimes the rest of the UK might learn from our mistakes. But we would exert a powerful positive influence through example, the beacon of progressive opinion. And independence would address a profound democratic deficit in Scotland. Not a passing inconvenience, but a debilitating disconnect at the very heart of politics. I'm 59 years old. Now, I can see you all thinking you don't look at... I know you're all thinking that. For more than half of my life, Scotland has been ruled with parties with no majority. In the last four UK elections, the Conservatives in Scotland have scored 0.1, 1, 1 and 1 seat, respectively, over the four elections. Now, this is not an abstract point, a constitutional theory. It affects the well-being and prosperity of individuals and communities across the country. The Conservative Party have lost every general election in Scotland since 1959, but have succeeded in ending up in government for 31 of the last 55 years. Now, I spoke earlier about the bedroom tax. It's a good example, not simply because it's unjust, although it is, but because it's a policy that would never have been passed by a parliament with Scotland's interests at heart. It's driven primarily by rising rental and housing benefit costs here in London and the southeast of England. And although 60,000 people in Scotland will be penalised unless they move into single-bedroomed accommodation, we currently have a supply of just 20,000 single-bedroomed homes for social rent. In many parts of the UK, the bedroom tax is unpopular. In an independent Scotland, it would have been unthinkable. Because of devolution, because of having the Parliament, the Labour Party, the Liberal Democrats and the SNP government have been able to work together in the Scottish Parliament to mitigate the impact of the bedroom tax. As a result, nobody will face eviction in Scotland this year solely as a result of that tax. But we haven't abolished the bedroom tax because the Scottish Parliament doesn't have the power to abolish the bedroom tax. Instead, we've developed an expensive framework of measures to try and cancel out the consequence of a policy that nobody in Scotland would ever have come up with in the first place. Wouldn't it have been better for us just to have responsibility for the welfare system instead of having to compensate for a policy we didn't vote for? And the bedroom tax is not an isolated example. Scottish MPs have voted against the welfare benefits uprating bill, child benefit means testing, cuts on capital spending, Royal Mail privatisation, and many, many more of the current coalition policies. But despite all of that, all of these policies have been or will be implemented in Scotland. When the Scottish people voted overwhelmingly for devolution in 1997, many of them thought it would address the democratic deficit in Scotland. However, devolution has dramatised, not ended, the democratic deficit. Now, that's partly because of the contrast people now see between the record of the Scottish Parliament and the record of the Westminster Parliament. There's a contrast of approach. In the northeast of Scotland last week, the UK Cabinet, on its third visit to Scotland in a century, jetted into Aberdeen and then jetted out without any engagement with the public whatsoever. The Scottish Cabinet, on our 26th public meeting outside Edinburgh in the last 6 years, advertised in the press to encourage as many people as possible to come along and asked the whole cabinet questions for the best part of an hour. There's also a contrast, I believe, in language. In some of the rhetoric that is used in a debate emanating from the Westminster Parliament, people are labelled. They're termed strivers or skivers, shirkers or workers. That language, thankfully, scarcely features in the debate in Scotland. There is a shared recognition that society isn't divided between skivers and strivers, one group who pay in, another who take out. Everyone contributes to society in different ways at different times, and everyone needs public support in different ways at different times. There's a contrast in policies. Successive Scottish parliaments, and I'm talking here about the Parliament as a whole, not any single party, have legislated for progressive purposes. We have promoted social justice alongside economic prosperity. Indeed, we see social justice as essential to sustainable economic prosperity. That doesn't mean we're perfect or we never make mistakes. It simply reflects the fact that members of the Scottish Parliament of all parties have worked to reflect the values, tackle the priorities, promote the aspirations of the people who voted for them. That's why there's a very clear majority of people in Scotland who want the Scottish Parliament to have control over welfare and taxation. And I believe over the next 6 months, that will translate into clear support for independence. It's interesting to look at the most recent Scottish Social Attitude Survey. This shows 62% of people, 62%, trust the Scottish Government to work in Scotland's interests. For the UK Government, the figure's 32%. And that helps explain why occasional visits by Westminster politicians to Scotland are being and will be received so badly. The first Scottish Parliament in 1999 introduced world-leading homelessness legislation. The second Parliament tackled Scotland's health inequalities through the ban on smoking in public places. The third Parliament reintroduced free university education and unanimously passed the most ambitious climate change targets in the world. This Parliament is seeing world-leading action to address Scotland's relationship with alcohol and legislation to expand, indeed transform, early years education and childcare. Alongside that, we've adopted policies to support economic growth, cutting business rates, promoting Scotland abroad, giving coordinated and very innovative support to capital expenditure and infrastructure and key sectors of the economy. We now have higher employment, lower unemployment, and lower economic inactivity than the UK as a whole. In the last 3 weeks, people in Scotland have been and have seen an array of approaches from the UK government, what they apparently call their dambuster strategy. We were love-bombed from a distance by David Cameron and then dive-bombed at close range by George Osborne. The UK cabinet came up to Aberdeen but chose not to meet the members of the public. I believe that George Osborne's speech in Stirling 3 weeks ago, the Sermon on the Pound, will come to be seen as monumental an error as Margaret Thatcher's Sermon on the Mound some 25 years ago. It encapsulates diktats from on high, which are not the strength of the Westminster elite, rather they're a fundamental weakness. And I want to make a contrast, and we shall make a contrast, that we will seek to engage with people across England on the case for progressive reform. George Osborne, in his speech in Scotland, referred to Scotland as foreign, a foreign country no less than 7 times. This was the danger, he said, making Scotland a foreign country. Yet the Chancellor surely knows that the Ireland Act of 1949, which was negotiated after infinitely more difficult circumstances than we have, specifically states that Ireland is not to be regarded as a foreign country. And Scotland will not be a foreign country after independence any more than Ireland, Northern Ireland, England or Wales could ever be foreign countries to Scotland. We all share ties of family, friendship, trade, commerce, history, culture, which have never depended on the Parliament here at Westminster and will endure and will flourish long after independence. Now, Osborne's speech was also mistaken in its economics. It totally misrepresented the size of Scotland's financial sector. It offered the most facile and misleading comparison with the Eurozone. It was counterproductive in its politics, a day-tripping Conservative minister saying no to Scotland before flying back to Westminster. And it contradicted above all the best interests of the rest of the United Kingdom. His proposed policy of no sterling zone, it would impose transaction costs on English businesses, it would remove Scotland's substantial oil and gas exports from the sterling balance of payments, and by laying sole claim to the as a continuing state to the public asset of the Bank of England, nationalised in 1946, it would see the UK government take full responsibility for the liability of the £1.6 trillion of national debt. Now, the New Statesman edition this week carries an article from David Shepherd, the professor at Northwestern in Chicago, who served as the US ambassador at large during President Clinton's administration. Professor Shepherd points out that, quote, nothing in international law requires Scotland to pay one sterling pound of UK debt if the rest of the UK is deemed a continuator state in this way. Now, I should stress that we've already indicated on page 345 of the White Paper that with agreement we would service a proportionate share of the UK national debt. Any reasonable approach to negotiation would propose a share of assets and a share of liabilities. That is simply the right thing to do. And therefore, for the Chancellor to put the rest of the UK potentially in a position of being landed with all of the UK's gargantuan national debt is at best reckless and at worst totally irresponsible. Now, it should be said that once the current campaign bluster is done with, I know, the UK government will return to the common sense reason set out in Clause 30 of the Edinburgh Agreement. That is that following the referendum, both sides will accept the result and act in the best interests of the people of Scotland and the rest of the United Kingdom. But this current dam-busters rhetoric has betrayed an attitude as antiquated as it is unacceptable. From the myopic perspective of the Westminster elite, Scotland is last among equals. And over the next few months, each and every time we hear another of these lofty interventions telling us all the things we can't do, it will elicit a clear response in Scotland, and that is that the days of governance by Westminster diktat are over. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there is a second future available to people of Scotland, one where we use the powers of independence to transform our country rather than mitigate other people's mistakes. So don't let them tell you we can't build a better country. Well, let's take childcare as an example. 2 weeks ago, the Scottish Parliament's Children and Young People Act was approved. It will see a major increase in childcare provision to 600 hours a week for many two-year-olds and all 3- and 4-year-olds. It's an important step, but one which falls short of our ambitions for childcare. Those ambitions for transformational change, I would submit, can only be achieved with independence. Now, that's partly because independence allows us to choose different spending priorities. We can decline, for example, to finance the madness of a new Trident programme and invest in the future instead. But most importantly, only independence allows us to benefit from the success of our policies. We've been part of a sustained drive to increase women's employment in the last 18 months. The female participation rate is now higher in Scotland than any country in the UK, having increased by over 3 percentage points in the space of 1 year, by 74,000 women now participating in the workforce. Using 2012 figures, getting female participation in the workforce up to the same levels they have in Sweden would require an increase of 6 percentage points or so. The scale of that increase translated into employment would generate around an additional £700 million a year of tax revenues. So what's the problem? Why don't we just go ahead and do it? Well, the problem is, under current arrangements, the overwhelming bulk of these revenues go straight to the UK Treasury in London. And I tell you, I can see no sign whatsoever in George Osborne's conduct over the last month, over his whole political career, indeed over his whole life, that the first thing he would do with £700 million of new revenues created by a Scandinavian-style transformation of childcare policies is to give these revenues back to Scotland to fund the policy that made it possible. Retaining that revenue in Scotland is what will make that transformation in childcare affordable and sustainable. With devolution, we bear the financial costs of social investment. With independence, we receive the full benefits. Second example is population. Back in November, the UK government welcomed a report from the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which was about actually as damning a criticism of its own policies as it's possible to imagine. And like last week's report from Standard & Poor's, which found Scotland's wealth levels to be comparable to Germany's, the Institute for Fiscal Studies recognised Scotland's current economic strength. Scotland has had a lower budget deficit than the rest of the UK over the last 5 years. The IFS made it clear that our debt-to-GDP ratio on independence would be lower than the UK's. However, the Institute of Fiscal Studies also predicted that Scotland's population might only grow by 4% in the next 50 years, while the UK's might increase by more than 20%. That's the main reason that the report was welcomed by the UK government. Now, this is part of a problem that goes back generations. Scotland's population has increased by just over 10% in 100 years, from 4.8 million to 5.3 million, while the population of England has increased by almost 60%. In recent years, successive Scottish governments, not just this SNP one, have worked to address that by attracting people to Scotland to study and then allowing these people to work if they wish to in our country. Until the UK government policy changed, we had some success. The 10 years from 2001 to 2011 saw Scotland's highest population growth in a century. In fact, we saw a higher growth in 10 years than the IFS is predicting over the next 50 years, which is perhaps a lesson why you should take population forecasts with an even larger pinch of salt than economic forecasts. However, any reasonable person reading that report would draw the conclusion that Scotland starts from a position of economic strength and that our long-term demographic challenge can be tackled. The UK government's approach is quite different. It seems to be suggesting it will do nothing at all about Scotland's low population growth. In fact, it will pursue immigration policies which make the problem worse. In other words, the UK government's vision for Scotland, if we stay tied to Westminster, seems to be one where Scotland, energy-rich, resource-rich, talent-rich, eventually becomes dependent on the rest of the UK at some unspecified point in the future because we haven't been able to address a problem that was a century in the making and which we have decades to sort out. Now, how can that possibly be a positive vision for the future of Scotland? And it raises the obvious question, why would anyone accept that future when instead we could choose to change it? Ladies and gentlemen, choosing to change, to seize opportunities, to meet challenges, is at the very heart of this debate that's taking place. What we want to do is to build a better future, to use our natural and human resources to create a fairer and more prosperous country. And the fundamental truth at the heart of the case for independence is that the best people to do that, the very best people to make decisions about Scotland's future, are the people who live and work in Scotland. At the start of this speech, I referred to the letter sent by the Scottish church leaders 25 years ago. I want to end with another voice from Scotland's post-war history. One of the finest Scottish political speeches of my lifetime was the Glasgow rectorial address given by Jimmy Reid in 1972. He spoke about the alienation felt by many people in society. He described it as the frustration of ordinary people excluding from the forces of decision-making, the feeling of despair and hopelessness that pervades people who feel with justification that they have no real say in shaping or determining their destinies. It's a speech which still resonates today. If anything, its relevance has increased over these decades. Now, independence on its own, it will not address alienation, although it will give us the powers to do something about it. But one truly wonderful thing about the debate that's happening in Scotland just now and the vote on the 18th September, it is fundamentally a time not for alienation, but for engagement and for hope. Because this referendum isn't about politicians. It's not about me or David Cameron. It's not even about David Bowie. It's not about Standard Life, and it's not about Standard & Poor's. It's not about the press, and it's not about the broadcasters. It's not about the elites in London or the elites in Edinburgh. It's about the people of Scotland. Adlai Stevenson once referred to a moment before presidential elections when people became reconciled to the requirements of the modern age. that moment of supreme clarity and often of fundamental reassessment he called the liberal hour. On referendum day, all of the people of Scotland, not just for the first time in 300 years, but for the first time ever, will be truly democratically sovereign. Everyone will have an equal say in the decision. And there'll be a moment for everyone in Scotland on referendum day when they stand in that polling booth and take the future of their country into their own hands. And that moment of opportunity, that moment of engaged sovereignty, the moment of clarity and for many of reassessment will come on the 18th September. Let's call it Scotland's hour. Because in that moment, and I believe from then on, Scotland's future will be in Scotland's hands. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, First Minister. That was well received, and unfortunately David Cameron didn't join us tonight. Maybe he's preoccupied with events in Ukraine. I'm going to ask some questions. I want to ask one myself before I open the floor. You're committed to a social union with England, and you made that clear in your Hugo Young lecture a couple of years ago. You're committed to a currency union. You're committed to a monarchical union. Given all this and the uncertainties you're creating for the Scottish people and Scottish business, surely your preference would be for some form of devolution max. Why go for independence?
Well, go for independence because Scotland's a nation. I mean, the fundamental case for independence is national self-determination. But because you're a nation and because you have the right to claim sovereignty, that doesn't mean you look for absolute sovereignty in each area. No country does that. You know, when Mark Carney made a speech in Edinburgh, which I thought was a very good, very judicious speech, where he was saying a monetary union involves the surrender of some sovereignty. All countries surrender some sovereignty. The point is in having the sovereignty that you are able, in the first place, to see in your best interest to surrender some of it. And I think it makes sense. The social union, does anybody seriously object? I mean, maybe Theresa May, I don't know, but does anybody seriously object to the social union? The monarchical union existed between Scotland and England for 100 years before the political union, before the Treaty of Union of 1707. The currency union makes sense, not just for Scotland, but for the rest of the UK. And these are entirely reasonable policies for the SNP government to put forward. But Jason, you'd mistake me if you didn't believe I was for independence.
I'm for, well, good. But surely at the present time, and you can tell me off the record if you want, that surely you favour at the moment Devo Max, and you wanted it on the ballot paper, Nick?
Yeah, off the record, Jason, I'm for independence. Yeah.
Okay. I hope that doesn't leak.
And also, the question, I mean, it's quite true. I thought it was a perfectly reasonable argument that people's choices should be reflected in the ballot paper.
Absolutely.
The one thing I insisted upon is independence would be in the ballot paper. That was the point of it. But the arguments I think are made in terms of this political union, Jason, is not just the remaining thing. You know that this one's quite important because it's the thing that dictates all of the other things I've been talking about this evening. It's the one that allows you to change society or not to change society. It's the one which either means you go forward trying to implement progressive policies or you spend a lot of your time trying to ameliorate policies which are being imposed from elsewhere.
Okay, First Minister, I won't ask another question in case we have a long answer and there's a lot of people with hands raised. Initially, I'm going to go for James Landau on the front row there, please, and then we should probably take questions in batches of three after this.
For all the campaigning that's taken place, public opinion in Scotland seems to be remarkably static. And if it doesn't change, we're going to lose. What do you think you have to do over the next 200 days to change that?
Well, we're actually, I'm glad you asked me that question, because we're actually releasing a poll of polls tonight, which shows all the, from each company, the opinion poll average from November, December, January and February. And it reads as follows. The figure for, this is a binary choice, yes, no, excluding don't knows. Yes has gone from 38% in November, 39% in December, 41% in January, and 42% in February, including the most recent polls. Now, James, you're quite right. If we continued at that rate of progress, we would just miss a magic majority. But I suppose my impression would be on recent experience, for example, in 2011, that as you move into the campaign proper, then the pace of change accelerates. I think we're moving in the right direction, but I also believe that, and this is at the very heart of certainly my recent experience in politics, that at the end of the day, if you put a positive message up against a negative message, then you'll win an election or you'll win a referendum. And the only way a negative message wins a campaign is if up against another negative message. And if you do that, then the most negative message wins. But you put a positive message, then you'll win the referendum, and we'll win it on that basis. Because at the end of the day, people will vote for something as opposed to against something.
OK, we'll take three now. We'll take Tom first. And I'm not going to privilege everyone in the front row. Then Peter, and then the gentleman there. So Tom first.
Right, so there's one thing I just don't entirely understand. The board says Scotland's future in Scotland's hands. I quite agree with you that I imagine the UK's default position after you win, if you win, would be to want a currency union. But it's quite possible that the rest of the UK might decide, if you wanted to go fiscally on a separate course, that actually they didn't want to be in a currency union. And the thing that I don't genuinely understand is why you don't seem more accepting that that's a possibility and plan accordingly. If this is all about having your future in your hands, why would you get so hung up on a currency union?
Well,
we take Peter. Peter Kellner.
Alex, you rightly expect your opponents, if you win however narrowly, to accept that this is the outcome for the long term. Equally, if you lose however narrowly, do you also accept that this settles the matter for some decades to come, or you won't go down the Parti Québécois route some decades ago, trying to reopen the issue every few years?
And one more there, please. Second one.
If you miss a magical moment and the outcome of the referendum is a no, what is your vision for a post-referendum Scotland after a no vote?
Right, in relatively quick succession, the Fiscal Commission Working Group, which is a high-powered group by Andy's estimation, a couple of Nobel laureates, and gave a full examination of currency policy options for an independent Scotland. They listed in that a range of options, many of which they considered to be viable for a country of Scotland's size and economic strength. But the best option, the favoured option, the one that they put forward and the one that the SNP government accepted, was the option of a currency zone, a sterling zone and a currency union. So we'll advocate that the best option. That doesn't mean there aren't other options that are there for people to read and have been there for the last year, and the Fiscal Commission's work is ongoing. But we'll put forward what is the best option. I agree with your assessment. I think what Osborne and et al., shall I call Ed Balls and et al., Osborne and Ed Balls are saying today will be entirely different from what they say the day after the referendum, for the reasons which I've given in the speech tonight. Peter, I've said a number of times, so I'll say again to you, that I believe referendums are once in a generation opportunity. There was a referendum in Scotland in 1979, there was another one in 1997. That's my idea of a political generation. But can I just say, for the benefit of the press here, and indeed for the benefit of the third questioner, is I'm entirely focused on victory in this referendum. And while I'm happy to speak about all sorts of range of options and things that can or can't happen, you'll forgive me if I predicate them on a yes vote in September, as opposed to anticipating a negative result. Just an observation of why I think that is not just the right, sensible thing to say, but it's also more important than that. I spent a lot of time, particularly a lot of time down here, in what could be called oppositionist politics. And there was a reason for that. When I became an MP, the SNP had 3 members of parliament in a House of Commons of 650. And if you're going to be noticed or be heard at all, then you had to jump up and down and make sure that somebody noticed or didn't realise there was only 3 of you. But the characteristic of that sort of politics, obviously, is quite different from the politics of creating and the politics of governance. And, you know, roughly about 10 years ago, I realised, and I'm amazed it took me so long, that if you actually wanted to win things and you wanted to persuade people to vote for something, then you had to adopt a different style of argument. And that had to carry through in everything you did. And so since then, and since I came back as SNP leader in 2004, I dedicated myself entirely to seeing the world in that, talking about what we want to do if the circumstances that we put forward come to pass. That's what we did in 2007, we did it again in 2011, we're going to do it in the referendum campaign. So this focus on a yes result is not just a pat political answer. It's something really important if you're going to be successful. And the emphasis on positivity and an argument that's acceptable, not just acceptable to people in Scotland, but as far as possible, acceptable to as many people outside Scotland as possible, is absolutely critical in winning this argument. You win this argument by persuasion and engagement, not by diktat and orders.
So that answers your third question about what might happen if there's a resounding no. OK, I'll take Jerry here in the front, and then I'm going to take 2 behind. So you first, sir. Gentleman with the beard, and then the lady in front of him. You first, please.
Thank you very much. Joey Jones from Sky News. Can I just ask you about the debate with David Cameron issue that you return to so often? It would seem obvious to pretty much everybody in this room why David Cameron shouldn't do that and why it would be disastrous for the campaign that he wants to support. If you genuinely believe there's the faintest chance of it happening, explain why. Explain what's in it for him.
OK, so the gentleman there in the middle row, you had your hand up. Do you want to ask your question? Yep. Okay, so it's the journalists, and then you, please, yes.
Hi, I'm Siobhan, I'm a London branch SNP member, and my question is actually quite similar to what that last guy asked. I'm quite concerned about bias in the BBC, and that the what seems to me the biggest political question in our generation seems to either get mostly ignored or just tacked on in a kind of jokey, or, you know, it doesn't really look at the question really in depth, and I'm, you know, a lot of stereotypes get pumped out and stuff like that, and I'm quite concerned that the level of the debate isn't really reflecting the level of debate amongst, certainly amongst people that I know. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay. I hope you read the New Statesman. There's certainly good debate in there this week.
Yeah, I just want to say I've got great hopes for the New Statesman as becoming the first publication to declare for independence. I mean, I'm confident.
Oh,
so Jason,
let me tell you now.
Don't ruin the moment, okay. Jason. Don't ruin the moment. They're all going to speculate for the next couple of weeks. Don't ruin the moment.
Let them
either
that.
Way.
You haven't been reading their leaders, do you?
No, I haven't been reading the leaders, but you've got 3 there, too.
Okay, I'm very grateful for your comment. Please answer those. Go ahead.
I think the reason that people go in for... It's a bit like the run-up to the last election, Jerry. If you remember, I don't think there was dramatic enthusiasm in 10 Downing Street for the debates, or for that matter from David Cameron. There was obviously dramatic enthusiasm from Nick Clegg, and basically it became more of a problem to say no than to say yes. And this is a problem for the Prime Minister. Now, it wouldn't have been a problem if he'd kept to his initial position of saying, this is a matter for Scots, you know, let the Scots decide, they're having the debate, I don't have a vote, etc. Because he didn't keep to that position. He decided to make statements from Mount Olympus He decided to dispatch the hit squad of William Hague and George Osborne up to Scotland. He put the whole cabinet up to Scotland. Now, once you get into a debate, it's very difficult to avoid the debate that people want to see. And the percentage of people in Scotland who want to see that debate are massive, I mean, overwhelming. And therefore, it becomes a problem. There's also a democratic reason, incidentally. And it's not just, and I keep promising the debate to every broadcaster who asks me the question. So clearly this would be a Sky debate for the public sector. I can see all the disappointment. But there's also the point that it was David Cameron and I who signed the Edinburgh Agreement. Now, he signed the Edinburgh Agreement as Prime Minister. I signed it as First Minister. And that agreement sets out the framework for the referendum campaign. And therefore, it seems reasonable, democratic, and thoroughly modern to have the television debate that is an essential part of all elections now and will be hereafter, and therefore should be of this referendum campaign. After that, of course, I'll debate all and sundry, but that's why I'm keeping up the pressure on the Prime Minister, because I think it's become and becoming and will become an even bigger political problem for him. In terms of the press, look, would I love if every Scottish newspaper was campaigning for independence? Absolutely. I would love that to be the situation. But the SNP won our first election in history in 2007 with both the major tabloids in Scotland campaigning vigorously against us. Indeed, the Sun front page in 2007 was an SNP symbol as a noose. But it was quite good, actually, because people just thought it was the SNP symbol, so they didn't realise that it was a kind of subliminal message, I think, or too complex a message, I think. It was a different story by 2011. But the point is that we won the election against that backdrop of a lot of press hostility. And therefore, I would love it if the press were different, but they're not. And so you fight the campaign that you know can be won under these circumstances.
Think Rupert Murdoch's Scottish Sun would declare for you?
Well, I've got great hopes of the New Statesman. I've got great hopes of the Sunday Herald. I've got great hopes of the Sun. I've got great hopes of a range of newspapers. But the questioner is right. If you assess the landscape as it is now, then let's put it this way, there'll be a majority of papers who are campaigning vigorously against us. In fact, some people would argue that the No campaign is essentially an unholy trinity of the Mail, the Express, and the Telegraph, which that is actually their campaign. Therefore, that is the ground we're on. So you play the ball as it lies, and you get on with it. Now, why I don't think it matters anything like as much as it did, and I'll answer the third question in this as well. We're not in a position where the newspapers dictate and the people obey. If we ever were, that position is long gone. There are many other forms of... I was watching, as Jason was putting up the various articles from the edition online on Saturday night, the trending of the various articles in this edition, and it's got some splendid articles in it.
Did you read mine?
Your one is particularly good. There's a bit about Alex Salmond being the most creative politician in Western Europe for 100 years. I thought that was why I thought you were coming out for independence, Jason, but never mind.
I get the message, Alex.
You get lots of opportunities which weren't there, and that is very much the stuff of politics. And there is another aspect which I think is quite fundamental, and the contrast between the SNP cabinet in Portlaoise and the UK cabinet, behind barbed wire, and that's metaphorical, they weren't actually behind barbed wire, in the Shell head office in Aberdeen. The meeting in Portlaoise was like one of hundreds of meetings that are taking place at community level across Scotland at the present moment, and they're fundamentally important. It's even better if you get a lot of publicity for them like that meeting had. But there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that replaces that style of campaigning. Not incidentally just because it's a means of communicating a message, it's how you communicate a message, because you can tell and sense the arguments which make sense to people, the arguments that convince, the arguments that don't convince, the style of campaigning that's effective in a way you can't do in a television studio. And the fact that such meetings get broadcast, as that one did live, I think, on Sky, at least part of it anyway. It gives a, you know, that is the perfect way to campaign. Don't underrate the extent to which this campaign is going to be won or lost on town hall style meetings. And very last point, Jason, and it's a point you actually make, I think, in your piece. This campaign is going to be a totally different demographic from a normal election campaign. There are people who are going to vote in this referendum who've never voted for 20 or 30 years. There are going to be people who are going to be registered to vote in this campaign who haven't been on the voter's roll since the poll tax. And there's a lot of people, incidentally, you know, if I could give one piece of advice to Progressive England, a number of MPs have been on about this for ages and ages. Don't underrate the people who are not on the voter's roll. You know, this country needs a registration campaign.
Certainly
and
Labour,
the referendum is part of that registration campaign. There's a very good article in Newsnight Scotland about campaigning in Castlemilk this weekend. And it's a good balanced article. It doesn't say this is easy, because it's not easy, but it does tell you what's being done. Don't underrate the extent to which the demographic of this referendum will change.
Okay, I'll just bring the thing I wanted to ask you, and it's you're very pro-business. You're very keen to cut corporation tax in Scotland, make it lower than whatever the London Treasury sets. I'm not popular with the left of your party. Mm. Your own personal polling among the fifth poorest Scots in your country is plus 26. So you have an extraordinarily positive rating among those who are least well off. The concern that some of your supporters who have spoken to me is that there's a division now along class lines. You're losing the middle class and you're losing business.
There's also a very active Business for Scotland group who are highly articulate and highly successful. But you quote some figures on it. Perhaps the reason is people, you know, I don't advocate a lower corporation tax because I want to make people rich. I advocate a lower taxation rate because I know that the Scottish economy will need things to resist the gravitational pull of London. I made a great amount of that in the speech. This is a real issue.
And won't you damage the north of England, the northeast of England, people with whom you have unity,
which
social solidarity?
I also made an issue of in the speech, because I think there is a way to reconcile and encompass. I do believe that we need to rebalance economic growth in these islands. I do believe in this Northern Light theory. I believe in the Borderlands initiative, which we're encouraging. Incidentally, some representatives from North England councils came to the SNP cabinet meeting in the Borders. To talk about these things, and I think there's a great opportunity for transport initiatives. I mean, we're building a fast rail in this country, and I saw a very substantial piece this weekend, really the first time, of somebody of authority saying, why are we building this fast rail south to north? Why aren't we building it north to south? You know, why is it going to be, 50 years of what it gets to the north of England? You know, what possible use is that for addressing economic inequality?
Hear from some more people. I'm going to go try and go to, forgive me, I just want to get some more people in from the back as time's tight. There's a lady who has a hand up at the very, well, two. Yes, you, madam, and then the lady just in front of you two, and then one other, the gentleman, who shall I go for? George on the front row. So, someone I knew, Paul. Two ladies at the back and then George.
Okay.
And then we'll try and get a few more in if we can.
Parallels are drawn constantly between Catalonia and Scotland, but you usually refuse them, saying they are totally different cases. I wonder if you are concerned that if you say publicly in any situation that Catalonia should have the same right as Scotland to do a referendum like the one you agreed with David Cameron in 2012, then Madrid might get concerned or somehow may be a bit more angry with you and trying to beat you. More than he's already threatening to do in the EU, for example.
Okay, thank you. And then just in front.
Thank you. Hi, I want to know why you were unwilling to disclose the legal advice regarding the EU.
You spoke of your commitment to social justice in your speech and suggested that Scotland would adopt a different approach to taxation. Would an independent Scotland reintroduce the 50p tax on incomes over 150,000, as Labour has now pledged to do?
Okay. So Spain, Claire.
I've never said that they're totally different cases. What I've pointed out is in Scotland, after a lot of negotiations, we have an agreed process, and that's what makes the cases different. It's not about a comment on Catalonia's aspirations or people of Catalonia. It's to say that you have to get an agreed process. I mean, Jason asked me a question earlier on about Devo Max on the ballot paper. It was crucial to get an agreement through the Edinburgh Agreement because this is a consensual process in Scotland and a lot hangs on that consent. And incidentally, in that consent, there is a valuable lesson for lots of people in lots of places. In terms of, we've published the Scotland and Europe document, which is based on the legal advice of the that we've received, and it's a comprehensive document that argues the route and that we approach, that we take to the question. It's a very well-founded document. And we are confident of that position. In terms of the white paper, we said that we don't have proposals for changing taxation. We certainly are not going to put ourselves in a tax disadvantage with the rest of the UK. In terms of the approach to social justice, I think that's validated by the policies we've pursued in administration. And if I had to point to one policy which I think will transform inequality in this country, then you should look very carefully at the policies for transformational childcare, which I think are absolutely fundamental in terms of... I've argued about them tonight in terms of the benefits to the economy and how it makes the case for controlling both sides of the balance sheet. The equally important arguments are the emancipation of people back into the workplace and what that can do for families, and secondly, the child development, which I think is fundamental to change some of these statistics we're seeing. Finally on that, the Scottish Parliament had actually, up until this point, in terms of child poverty, has had a pretty good record. It's decreased substantially since 1999 and continued to do so even over the last 3 to 4 years. But the warning signs in terms of social security changes are absolute in terms of where these changes are going to impact on families. And the forecasts of tens of thousands, perhaps more, or more children in poverty, unless we change these things, I think are absolutely soundly based.
Okay, I'm aware you have to do your broadcast interview, so should we take three more? I will come to you, sir. Let's take four. Gentleman in the pale blue shirt with your left hand raised in the middle. Can we get a microphone to him? The lady at the very back with spectacles. Then Anthony Barnett. And then, sir, do you want to come in? You've been very patient. So there'll be the four. So the gentleman with the pale blue shirt. Thank you. You first, sir.
This lady's question wasn't answered at all. The EU question
was answered. Okay, maybe the First Minister will address that. Okay, the EU question.
No,
there's a feeling you haven't answered
the lady's question on Catalonia.
No, there was a second question about...
Well, as I said, we published the Scotland and Europe document, which was published on the same day as the White Paper, which is based on the legal advice we've received. By a long-standing position, I mean, that's based on the legal advice, and there's no dispute about that. They don't have a dispute about legal advice, dispute about whether the paper has been published. The Scotland and Europe document was published on the same day as the White Paper. It's available to read. It's on the government's... website. You're free to read it. It sets out, the white paper crystallises it. It sets out the process by which we believe Scotland will become an independent member of the European Union using Article 48. This matter is being well examined in the Scottish Parliament committees at the present moment. It's received some very, very powerful support from people like David Edwards, Court of Justice, from Secretary Generals, past Director Generals. It doesn't quite get as much enthusiasm from President Barroso, but there's been a bit of a Barroso backlash across Europe in terms of the position of his statements. I was told that accused of the SNP not being very kind to President Barroso. Actually, he was called absurd by David Edwards, the Court of Justice. He was called arrogant by the former Czech president and inappropriate by the leader of the French Senate.
You're very keen on him.
So we have
those four questions.
I'm just quoting others.
Yeah.
I'd like to refer to just about one sentence, I think, that Mrs. Salmon raised about Trident. Now, that may be a sentence which is a lot more than you often hear in this country. So may I congratulate you at least for a very clear statement that you would not continue on Scottish territory with the Trident base. I'm a member of the Labour Party, and we're supposed to have had a great debate, but it's time that this debate also, I think, was rekindled in this country as well. I'd be interested to know what you think the if Scotland did vote for independence, what the implications of that would be.
Are you a unilateralist, sir?
I would be in favour of this country, as South Africa did, renouncing its weapons of mass destruction.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
At the far back, you've been waiting. Have you got a microphone? Okay, it's coming your way. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to know what you're actually going to do, concrete examples of what you're going to do to stop Edinburgh being the dark star of an independent Scotland, and how we're not just replacing London for Edinburgh. I come from Caithness. The hospital's phone number is 50-50. You've got a 50-50 chance of coming out alive.
Wow.
Our train that goes north from Inverness to Thurso is two carriages. One's got the toilet, the other's got the lights.
So your own metaphor of the dark star is being used against you.
Right.
Anthony Barnett, in the second row, is a microphone, please. And then we'll have one more, and then we really must wrap up.
Thank you, yes. I want to ask you a question about England. I'm an Englishman who would like your country to vote yes. And there's a very entertaining piece, article by Will Self in The New Statesman, in this issue, where he basically says, you know, he was for independence, but perhaps, you know, he makes this point that the caricature of the Scots are sort of canny and mistrustful. This is projection. This is really what we English think of ourselves as being, and we need Scotland to save us in a way from ourselves. And there's a kind of nerveless failure of a desire for self-government in England, it seems to me, and I wondered whether you've reflected on that and how we English can grasp, be inspired by what you're doing.
Good. And the last question, because we have the interviews.
Okay.
The gentleman there in the front row has been waiting. Could you put a microphone here, please? Eleanor, thank you very much. No, sir, it's this gentleman here in the very front row. I apologise.
Yeah, I'll speak up. It's Felix Martin here.
I didn't recognise you without your beard.
No, I know, without my beard. I found your case very persuasive, but there was one thing I thought was a strange sort of contradiction. You painted a very vivid picture of what is wrong with the economy south of the border, the dark star in London, and the black hole in the balance of payments that will appear when Scotland leaves and so on. And yet, you are very keen to yoke yourself to this in this currency union. Why is this the case? Clearly, you think the economies are different. Clearly, they will diverge even more. Why is that the best option? I don't think it's a very good answer which will wash to say some clever chaps told me to do it on the Fiscal Commission, many of whom I would point out don't even live in Scotland. So why is it that you want to do that? What's the positive case? As you said, the positive case is important for being in that currency union with this dark star economy.
Right. Well, the fact that the clever chaps don't stay in Scotland didn't seem to me all that relevant to asking for the advice of Jim Merlies or Joe Stiglitz. I thought I would take the best advice that was available, and I've got no reason to believe that either of these, or indeed the other economists on the Fiscal Commission, were doing anything other than giving us their best advice. And it's really good advice. And one of the bits of advice in the Fiscal Commission Working Group report has a full page of the economic levers that we don't have at the present moment, which we will have in a currency union. Not just tax and spend policies, but also the full range of competition policy, oil and gas policy, a range of other economic levers. I mean, a full page of levers. Now, none of these things we have control of at the present moment, Felix. All of these things we'd have control of in an independent Scotland, one within a sterling zone. On the question of Trident, it was. I loved the way you asked the question. It was one sentence, and I wish it could have been a lot more. We've had a long-standing opposition to nuclear weapons in the SNP. Trident will be removed from Scotland as soon as it can safely be arranged. I can't dictate, of course, whether the rest of the UK will want to continue to be a nuclear power. If they took my advice, the answer would be no, they shouldn't. But I can't dictate that. But what I could estimate, I think an independent Scot will make the idea of Trident renewal totally out of the question. I think even within the structures now, it's a balance. It certainly would kill the idea of Trident renewal, in my estimation. We are not going to repeat the Dark Star. Listen, if the SNP government were as you thought in terms of regional disparity, we wouldn't have won the election in 2011 in every single area of Scotland. North, south, east, west. The remarkable thing about the SNP victory was that it wasn't concentrated at all in any part of Scotland. It was right across the country. In terms of concrete policies, then, I think we'll have to get the toilets on the trains and sort out the hospital. But I would just point out that if you look at the latest census, then you'll see the Highlands and Isles of Scotland are one of the fastest growing areas of population now. A depopulation that was changed in the 1960s by Tom Johnson and the Hydroelectric Board, and now, and particularly over the last 10 years, is going in a totally different direction. So the idea that rural Scotland is being held back, and in fairness to my area of the northeast of Scotland, Edinburgh actually isn't the most prosperous area of Scotland, it's the northeast of Scotland at the present moment. But that importance of having an economic policy which meets and seeks support from the entire country is of fundamental importance, as indeed it is in terms of society as a whole. Can I say about Will Self's article? I thought it was really good, actually, but I can't quote from it, because if I quote from what Will says about England, it'll be projected onto me as if I'd said about. But I did like the idea, and I took from his article support for Scottish independence, and I don't actually think Will does have a downer. He actually says that he thinks Scottish independence will allow people in England to confront some of the issues that need to be confronted here. I was once asked, I think, by...
I'll never quite know what
well,
he thinks.
Well, I mean, I've missed out a few of the terms, admittedly, because I'm not allowed to say them, but nonetheless, that's the Jim. I was once asked by Jeremy Paxman, Jason, about a lot of people not believing about independence, and I said back to him, I said, yeah, he's quite right, a lot of folk in the country have got doubts about independence and self-government, their ability to be an independent nation. But in my estimation, the people of England were well capable of independence. And it's not just a good reply to Jeremy Paxman. It's actually absolutely true. This country, of all countries, has the reservoir. I mean, this country is so much better than the Westminster government. I mean, it's simply so much better. And it might well provide that catalyst. I hope it will. To provide a different answer to real questions in this country and take charge of this nation's resources and distribute them properly.
Yes, I said there'd be no more questions, but one gentleman's waiting very, very patiently at the very back. So as briefly as you can, sir.
Sure, this is a decent question to finish off the evening.
Thank you.
If you read any of the works of religious prophets, the one word that comes up more than anything else is the word will. Things will happen. Things will come to pass. First Minister, your speeches and your documents contain the word will rather a lot. Do you consider yourself a political prophet?
No, that's because I had Will Self write the speech. No, that wasn't bad, actually. I quoted a few prelates in the speech, but I don't consider myself a religious prophet or a prophet, or I consider myself a politician who is privileged to be in a position to put forward a positive case for national independence for my country and I'm going to do over the next 6 months everything I can possibly do, not just to win that argument, but to win that argument in the right way, to win that argument by engaging people across the country in what the country can actually do. And I believe we'll win. I've got that feeling in my bones, but I also know absolutely for certainty that we will fight that campaign in such a way as when we look back and say, look, that campaign itself made the country a better, more engaged, progressive place.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. I think that was even warmer than when you arrived, so you've convinced a few people out there. Again, I'm very grateful for you coming down to Westminster to address the audience here so openly, to take questions. We could have gone on, of course. You're not a prophet, we accept that. But there's one thing worth bearing in mind. The SNP going into the Scottish election in 2011, the final 4 weeks of the campaign were about, 15%, 20% behind in the polls, and they turned it around in 4 weeks and won a landslide. Just worth bearing that in mind. There's actually a drinks reception for those of you who wish to stay below ground in something called the Marble Hall, which sounds like a Ukrainian oligarch's flat in London, but it's below this level. If you want to stay for a drink, I think the First Minister, you'll be joining us after you've done your broadcast interviews. Thank you very much, everyone. Thanks again. Thanks. Great fun.
Yeah, good fun.
Great fun. Great fun. Thanks so much.